Welcome to the podcast that is all about self-employment. We'll be sharing expertise on getting started, getting noticed, and getting it right, as well as dealing with getting it wrong. Your host, Julia Kermode, will help you get ahead so you get the success you deserve.
Welcome to today's episode, and I'm really delighted to have with me Dave Chaplin. He is an expert in IR35. Some of you listening will be thinking, what the heck is IR35? And that is really what we're here to talk about. It's actually really important that all self-employed people are aware of IR35 and what it is. And in particular, there are some changes coming next year that we're going to get into. But for now, Dave, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Julia. Yes, my name's Dave Chaplin. I'm the founder of a website called Contractor Calculator, and also a company called IR35 Shield. And I've been in this industry now for over 20 years. And I was a former contractor myself in the 90s in the IT sector. And I used to lead teams of developers to build finance systems and legal systems. And then I founded Contractor Calculator in around 2000. It was called something else then. Yeah. And we've been providing advice and guidance and championing the contractor workforce for the last 20 years.
And that's quite an interesting thing in itself for listeners who don't know anything about the world. So I'm guessing quite a few of our listeners are newly setting up as self-employed. And so this whole area is going to be quite new to them. And I think it's fair to say you've been part of the IR35 expertise and advice giving right from the start. So I think IR35 started in 1999, but you tell me, because you will know better than I do. But what actually is IR35, and why do we need to know about it?
Well, there's no such thing necessarily as IR35. It's just a label that's used to point to now two pieces of legislation in the Finance Act. The I and the R stand for Inland Revenue, and 35 stands for the number of the note that was released in March 1999 that first signaled the start of this particular piece of legislation. That's when it became an idea. It actually became law in April 2000. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's been around for a very long time. And it was originally brought about because there was the perception by the then Inland Revenue that the idea was there were many individuals then that were working for companies, and particularly in IT, and the government perceived that they were all becoming contractors overnight and leaving these companies where they were employees on a Friday and then going to work for these companies on a Monday, doing exactly the same thing, but yet working through a limited company and thereby not paying as much tax as they were before. Now, that's how it was essentially sold to the market and sold to the MPs, and that's how what was implemented. If we cast our minds back 20 years, we had the dot-com boom.
Yeah.
We had the millennium problem. Mm. And the premium paid for contractors in that era was significantly more than it is now. And you couldn't get people. So the only way you could really hire contractors was to promise to hire them on a what's now referred to as an outside IR35 basis. So the market rallied and made sure that they were hiring contractors on a contractual basis, whereby they were outside IR35. Then I guess the fight began.
So I guess when you're talking about the millennium problem, you're meaning the millennium bug problem. Just in case our listeners think it was just the kind of turn of the millennium that was the issue, but the millennium bug, I remember it really well because I was in my youth then, or certainly younger than I am now, and there were all these kind of nightmare news stories that all computers were suddenly going to go pop overnight when we changed into the new millennium. So I obviously wasn't in the contracting sector at that point in time. But what I'm guessing is that a lot of companies needed IT people on a short-term basis purely to help with that Millennium Bug project. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely true, particularly in the finance industry. So the Millennium Bug was where lots of computer systems, which in those days, remember, computer memory was expensive. So when software developers were building computer systems, you tried not to use up much memory. So instead of putting the data in, this is going to sound ridiculous now in 2020, but the when you program something and you put a date into the computer and you set aside an amount of memory, you would only use two digits for the final year. So if it was 1998, you'd be putting in 98. Now, this meant that at the turn of the millennium, though, that figure would become 00. So all of the maths associated with date maths, particularly in finance organizations, when you're planning forward FX rates and interest rates and all this kind of thing, the whole lot would break. It just wouldn't work. So they needed to open up all of these software systems that hadn't been touched for years. And lots of these banking systems in those days, I don't know about now, were held together with sticky tape, I would say. They all had to be fixed. And lots of COBOL programmers were coming out of retirement. Lots of systems had to be completely replaced because no one even knew where the original source code was. So it's a massive problem, which does sound crazy today, but 20 years ago, it was huge. So tons of programmers were just hired to actually solve that problem.
Okay, so we've always got the Millennium Bug to thank for for this piece of legislation then. And so that's quite interesting, because although I've been in the in this sector for a number of years, I hadn't really quite realised that that actually the Millennium Bug that I remember quite well is partly to blame for current situation. So what exactly is IR35 legislation intended to do? Why is it a problem for a company to pay someone to do work for them on a short-term basis rather than employ them on a short-term basis?
Well, IR35 and the name of the legislation that was introduced in April 2000 is called the Intermediaries Legislation, but we will refer to it as IR35. The reason it was introduced was simply about tax, and the government saw that people who were hired and operated via their own limited companies were not paying as much tax, and I say that in terms of a percentage amount of tax, compared to an employee. And we have, and in order to make that argument, you have to consider the total amount of cost of hiring an employee. So if you're a salaried employee, you'll be used to the concept of a salary being offered to you. So let's say you're offered £50,000 a year. But then you'll then have to pay employees national insurance, which comes out of that 50,000. And you'll also have to pay income tax, which comes out of that 50,000. But your employer has to also pay taxes on top of that. And they are called secondary class one national insurance contributions, or in short, employers national insurance, or employers NI. Now, I can't remember what the rate was back then, but now it's 13.8%. And that's on top of that £50,000 that you're being paid as a salary. So that's an extra cost. Now, if a firm hires a contractor who operates via their own limited company, then they don't have to pay that employer's national insurance. And if you look at the difference in tax that's paid between someone operating as a salaried employee and someone operating as a permanent employee, of the extra tax that HMRC are trying to chase, about 80% of that extra tax is due to the fact that employers NI does not have to be paid. So this entire history of IR35 is all about, really, employers national insurance. That's what it's about.
Okay, and that's quite interesting. So that's not the impression that HMRC like to give. They like to give the impression that it is people working for themselves, not paying as much tax as employees. But as you've outlined really, really clearly, the difference is that the fact that employers are not paying the employers' national insurance.
That's true. But historically, I think that argument that HMRC have been using had some validity. Because historically, I think it was, 2016, I might be wrong on the date, where they changed the tax regime for dividend tax. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, actually, the amount of tax a contractor paid on their income compared to an employee was actually quite a bit less. I mean, just to compare a salary with the amount of money that comes into a limited company, it did used to be less, but then they changed the way taxes on dividends were done, which is how a contractor would typically pay themselves via their own company.
Yeah.
So prior to that change, I think that argument had some validity, but then after that change, no, it doesn't really. It doesn't hold weight. The entire story now, as everybody in the industry knows, this is all about employers' national insurance.
Yeah, and there are some useful graphs that illustrate the point really clearly. And I know I've certainly used them when I've done presentations in this. So we might put those on the show notes page for people to see, because it can be a bit confusing when we're trying to describe something verbally, and some people might want to see the graph. So we can I'll make sure we put that up. Just very briefly, if you are working through your own limited company as a self-employed person, you've kind of touched on how they typically pay themselves, which my understanding would be a small amount as salary, and then the remainder you take out from the limited company as dividends. Is that still the correct ways? Is that how most limited company contractors work?
It's how most contractors are advised by their accountants to operate in the most tax efficient manner.
Yeah.
It's always been that way, really. It's how most small businesses, whether they're contractors or not, will remunerate themselves.
Yeah.
Typically a small salary, about, I don't know, £8,000 to £10,000 a year, and then whatever's left, you tend to just, as a contractor, you keep a float running and you leave mm-hmm. all the money in the company and you take out what you need, because you know that at some point you won't have any work.
Yeah.
And you might have 3 or even 6 months where you won't be working. So you try to save up. I advise people to save up a buffer mm-hmm. of about 6 months' money so that we're actually, when they are thinking about taking on a particular contract somewhere, they don't find themselves in a desperate situation and can't negotiate so well. So yes, it's not always that the money's taken as dividends on a monthly basis. It's as and when they choose to.
Yeah. And I suppose it's worth kind of making the point that the money belongs to the company, and then the directors and shareholders own the company. So it's kind of indirectly, it's not actually the contract rate that they charge is not actually necessarily their income, because obviously they'll have business costs as well. And I think the other point to make is that sole traders, therefore, because how sole traders structure their income, they pay tax and national insurance on an annual basis through their self-assessment. And they are, correct me if I'm wrong, sole traders are not targeted by IR35 legislation.
Sole traders are definitely not targeted by the IR35 legislation, but they are potentially targeted in another manner, in the sense that if, as a company, you hire someone who is a sole trader, HMRC at a later date can come along and say, that person wasn't really a sole trader, were they? You should have hired them as an employee. You owe us this much money. And this is why companies want to engage with limited companies, whether it's one person in that company, whether it's multiple people. If you set up a consultancy with 10 people in it, another company is not going to hire you on a sole trader basis. They want to interface with another company, and they want to do that because they want to have certainty over their tax affairs and their balance sheet to essentially be risk-free. So, this is why most companies, particularly for in the high-end part of the market, will only engage contractors through limited companies because they don't want the tax risk.
Can I pick up on your other point?
Because you made a very important point about the fact that it's not the contractor's money that's in the company. That's absolutely true. And unfortunately, we do see in some of the less informed media where there is people talking about this being tax avoidance and so on. And they say, well, that person charges this much per day and they only pay corporation tax of 18%, whereas the higher rate of tax is 40%. Well, that's just a half truth because, as you say, that money needs to come out of the company and gets paid to the person. And when that happens, that's a taxable event and that has to be declared on the self-assessment tax return. And if you don't, that would be fraud and all the usual income tax rates apply. It's actually the case where if you are an additional rate taxpayer and you are a contractor, the combined rate of the corporation tax and then taking into account the 45% rate, your marginal rate of tax is more than an employee at that point. And if you are a contractor that earns more than about £1,100 a day, which let's face it, would be wonderful if anyone could earn that. But the maths tells us that if you are in that sort of zone, then you pay more tax as a contractor compared to if you were paid that as a salary.
Okay, I'm feeling the need for a diagram of that as well for our notes page.
I'll happily provide you one of those. And yeah, I mean, one of the benefits is that companies want to hire via a limited company. And the new legislation actually changes that. Now, so we've got IR35, but that was the old legislation. The old legislation is still in existence and it will still stay there. And it still applies to contractors if they're working for small companies. But the new legislation, which is a separate chapter in the Finance Act, this is called off payroll. So we should refer to the sort of old legislation and new legislation. The new legislation does actually put a tax risk on the hirer's books, whereas the old legislation didn't. And this is the major problem, because whilst they have essentially fixed what I would consider to be a cruel part of the old legislation, it's created a new tax risk for the hirers. So under the original legislation, the rules say that the total amount of money that the contractor's been paid should be considered as the total cost of hire, including that employer's NI. So what that means is, under the old legislation, is that if you, and you're supposed to self-assess on this, if you self-assess as inside IR35, then the amount of tax you're paying is even more than an employee. Wow. Now, that's just crazy, right? Because you don't get any of the rights and so on and so on. And it's just entirely unfair. Why are you paying someone else's tax bill? Now, under the new legislation, the rules are different. It says the amount of money the contractor has been paid has to be treated as employment income, and the hirer should be paying their employment taxes. So the right people should be paying the right amount of tax. But what that does mean is that if a company hires someone who they think is outside IR35 and you just carry on, then at a later date, HMRC could knock on the door and say to the firm, well, hold on a second, we don't agree with the decision that you made. You need to pay us this much tax. And after you take into account all of the offsets, it's all of that employer's NI. So they now have a tax risk on their books. And that's why we start to see some of these companies decide that they won't hire anyone who operates via a limited company anymore, which is unfortunate. And frankly, I think it's a bit, it's far too risk averse and unnecessary, but it's happening.
Yeah. I mean, we might see a slight change in attitude anyway, given the current situation that the world is in terms of, I guess, some businesses will need work and projects doing what as and when they can get to a point of recovery from the pandemic. And I can't see businesses employing people permanently in this current situation. If I was looking at extra resources, I wouldn't be taking on employees at the moment. I would be looking at bringing people in to do what I need, bring the skills in to do what I need, and then that's it. So I'm hoping that actually, bizarrely, the current pandemic, etc., will be quite positive for the world of self-employment and contracting and temping. And what's your thought? We're going slightly off topic, by the way, but but that's
no. I think it's very relevant because you know, it's interesting to examine what the behavioural effect of COVID might be on the freelance sector. There's a few schools of thought on this. I entirely agree that if you're a company, you won't be looking necessarily to hire permanent employees, particularly for those one-off projects. I mean, that's what contractors are for, really. So once you've decided that you don't want to hire permanent employees, you then have a few options. You can either decide that you're going to still hire them by their own limited companies, in which case after April next year, you'll need to do the assessment regime and so on and go through the various administrative stuff that you need to do. Or you might decide that actually the market is fairly is more in your favour as a hirer, and there's lots of people sat on the bench, and you could maybe as a default decision decide to take a risk adverse approach and just say we're only hiring people and putting them on payroll, whether it's their payroll or the agency payroll. Mm-hmm. So you could just decide to do that as a risk adverse option. But where that may well become a problem for companies is where there's an issue with the supply and demand. So if they can't get the people because those people aren't prepared to go onto payroll and they have choices, they will go with the companies who are prepared to hire them properly on an outside basis, because that's essentially what their status really is in law. The other area where it will be very difficult for companies is those that are in far off locations. For example, there's no nuclear power stations in the middle of London. They tend to be far off places, and nuclear sites, places where you build nuclear subs, those kind of, you know, defense organizations, they tend to hire in very niche skills. People travel to them on a Monday, leave on a Friday, and have accommodation during the week. Mm. Same for the oil industry. So yeah, these kinds of contractors will have expenses in the region of £20,000 a year, which normally they would offset against their earnings. Well, if they're told they need to go on agency payroll or the firm's payroll or fixed term contracts, then there's no opportunity for them to offset their valid expenses. And they will be commanding rates that will probably be about a third more than what they're currently being paid. So market forces will certainly come into play as to how this will shake out.
Just for absolute kind of clarity, so those business expenses that are valid business expenses, whether you're working for yourself as in a limited company or whether you've got more stuff or whatever, they're perfectly valid business expenses. But I think the nub of the changes that are coming in will, rather than paying a business an amount gross, will put them through payroll, put that contract rate through payroll, essentially. And so by virtue of being paid via payroll, you're already taxed, so you don't get the opportunity to have your expenses taken into account before tax. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. Under the original legislation, you could account for 5% of your total income.
Yes.
Could be used as a sort of like a tax-free amount to cover your expenses. Under the new regime, Chapter 10 of the Finance Act, the off-payroll legislation, there's no opportunity to offset any expenses whatsoever. Everything you earn is considered as salary.
That's really unfair, actually, because when you think of running your business as through your limited company, you have lots of other expenses. It's not just 100% salary. I don't know we said that earlier, but it's an important point that I want people to really realise. And it is really unfair, some of these aspects of the legislation.
It's massively unfair. If you consider what let's call them a genuine contractor does. A genuine contractor who's always engaging in law on an outside IR35 basis. Now, these people invest in their own training and development.
Yeah.
They're often working certainly more than 40 hours a week. They travel all over the country, some of them. They will pay for their own courses. They'll pay for their own training. They have downtime. And what do you do when you're a genuine contractor is you're basically putting your hand up saying, I'm going to make sure that I know the best about my subject.
Yeah.
And I'm going to offer that to you. You're going to pay a premium. And if at any point during the engagement you think that I'm not good enough, you can fire me on the spot and there's absolutely no repercussions whatsoever.
Yeah.
That's the deal. And firms like that, they like the fact that they are hiring that expertise and they can hire and fire at will. And contractors who like to consider themselves the best in their field also like that deal too. They like the fact that they're putting their themselves on the line every day and making sure they have to be the best that they are. And this arrangement is just great for UK PLC to have these flexible workers traveling around the country, having multiple clients, and everyone upping their skills. And delivering those services to those customers. If people can't do that and everybody needs to be employed by one firm, it will lower that skills base because there's some of these skills that you just can't work for one company a year and do it because the one company doesn't need you for the whole year. So if you were paid half of that money just to work for one firm, well, you're not working for the other firm, so they don't even get those skills. So it's clogging up the flexible workforce in this manner is one of the unintended and damaging side effects of this particular piece of legislation.
Yeah, and we're going to come on to that in a second, actually, because the off-payroll changes came into the public sector in 2017, and we want to talk a little bit around that, some of the impacts there. But yeah, you're quite right. This whole flexible workforce thing is really important. And the last figures I had, so I'm probably a couple of months slightly out of date, but the last I knew, say pre-pandemic, was at least 20% of the UK's workforce was working in non-permanent work, whether that's self-employed as sole traders, whether that's agency temps, whether that is contractors in the way that we're talking about them today. And that's a huge amount of the workforce. So it seems to me HMRC could be seen as almost shoehorning all of those people onto payroll where it's quite inappropriate. And so I just thought I'd make that comment. It's a large number of people that are affected by this.
It's an enormous number of people. In the impact statement for the rollout to the private sector, when you take into account what they said in the impact statement, some other publications, we're looking at, well, sort of, certainly more than 500,000 people. There's some estimates that it might be as high as 700,000 or 800,000 people. And it's naive, actually, of the Treasury and HMRC to sort of shoehorn all of these people into payroll, thinking that they'll end up making more money out of this. There's a slide I think I'm going to provide you that shows the three pieces of pie. And contractors just charge more money compared to their permanent counterparts. I mean, you and I have talked about this a long time, haven't we? I've referred to it as the freelance premium. So if a permanent worker is paid a salary of 50,000 a year, is say in IT, I mean, this is mainly the area I know most about. Typically, if you wanted to hire that same person with the same skills but on a freelance basis, you'll be paying them up to double, sometimes more. So the Treasury is actually getting anyway a smaller piece of a much bigger pie. Whereas they just want more pie.
They do. And I suppose...
their argument is all about percentages and not amounts, which drives me crazy.
And I suppose the advantage to the business for bringing in, say, an IT contractor, for sake of example, and paying them more, I guess they pay them more than they would a permanent employee because they don't need them there permanently, right? So it's just a short-term arrangement and everyone's happy.
I mean, they don't choose to pay them more on any reason other than that's the market rate.
Yeah.
And those rates change. So, I mean, we were talking earlier on about the millennium bug and the dot-com boom. So if I cast my mind back to that era, crikey, I went contracting in 1997 and finished in 2004. And after the dot-com crash and after we'd fixed the millennium bug that everyone then said didn't exist after we'd fixed it, pretty funny. after that, there was a massive fallout. There was a financial crash around that time as well. Mm-hmm. And rates halved overnight, almost. And they took probably about 10 years to recover again. And by 2008, when we had that next crash, they went down again. Okay. So the market sets what the rate is, but it's fair to assume that self-employed people, or people who want to work for themselves, whichever vehicle that they choose to do, you don't leave a permanent employment position and go into a market whereby you're working for yourself, where you end up earning less and taking more risk. Yeah. That's not how a capitalist democracy actually works.
It wouldn't be a sensible decision to make.
It doesn't work that way. That the free market dictates that freelancers charge more for their services than permanent employment.
So let's chat through a bit about the public sector changes. So just for listeners to understand, the off-payroll changes that are coming in next year, HMRC already brought more or less the same changes into the public sector only in 2017. So we have got some kind of insights as to the impact there. And broadly, the changes, and Dave will correct me if I'm wrong, but broadly the changes were basically the business hiring you as a self-employed person through your limited company, basically now have responsibility to decide if you look more like an employee or whether you are genuinely in business on your own account. And we will probably talk through some of the detail in relation to what does that mean and how on earth do you know whether you look like an employee or not in our next episode. But that's broadly the change that came in. But Dave, you tell us, because you're more of an expert.
Yeah, so the original legislation prior to 2017 said that the contractor has to assess whether or not they consider themselves to be a deemed employee by applying various law around the concept of employment and employment status. The rules that came in 2017 introduced it's a whole new chapter of the Finance Act, and it said that the hirers in the public sector were responsible for making the decision as to whether that particular person operating via a limited company is a deemed employee or not, and then had to make those tax deductions and pay that extra employer's NI on top. So deduct from the amount the contractor's paid and also pay the extra taxes. The other thing to say about the public sector is we saw rates skyrocket. Which is not surprising, because contractors basically said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be mistreated this way. I'm off. The only way the public sector could then attract those people back in, if they were then put on payroll, was to pay them more so that they ended up with the same money in their pocket. That's just supply and demand. So we have this bizarre situation where the public sector said, okay, well, we'll just pay you more then to cover all those extra taxes. The contractor still ended up with the same amount of money in their pocket. All of those extra taxes were paid over to the Treasury, who then paid them to those bodies, which then paid them to the contractors, which paid them to the Treasury. And we had this ridiculous merry-go-round where actually it made no difference whatsoever. Yeah. Now, the private sector is different. They're not going to just suddenly be pressured into handing over, you know, sort of 20, 25, 30% extra when they don't need to, and they have a strong position in law that says that they don't have to.
Yeah. And I suppose the major difference, is, as you've kind of outlined, is that the government controls the public sector ultimately. So the government can say to the NHS or to schools or whatever government department it might be, this is how we want you to operate. This is, you know, whereas they can't tell businesses that same, they don't have that same level of, well, I would say dictatorship, but that might be a strong word. But they don't have that level of control over businesses, because businesses are their own entities, and they're in business to kind of make their own decisions.
Absolutely. I mean, if there's two businesses and one of them decides that they want to be unnecessarily risk adverse and put everyone on payroll, particularly in an area where they are competing for the best talent in the market, in the freelance market, then they will be put at a disadvantage and they will earn less money, and their shareholders might ask them, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
Because the other company will decide to put in a proper assessment regime, has everything in place, carries on a hiring contractors on an outside basis, that they are on that basis in law, I must add. They're not, there's no tax avoidance going on.
Yeah.
And they'll be at a competitive advantage. So the free market will play a hand in this. We are seeing some companies deciding to just ban contractors. Mm-hmm. And it's worth reminding your listeners that whilst this is coming in 2021, it was supposed to come in April 2020, and yeah, it was only delayed literally weeks before. So we had a dress rehearsal this time last year for about 5 months, and we saw what companies were going to do.
Mm.
And lots of them, particularly financial institutions, were deciding just not to engage contractors who operated via their own limited companies.
Just think of the dress rehearsal we saw for this year's changes. We did see, as you quite rightly said, a lot of the financial institutions just deciding not to engage contractors at all through their limited companies. So what was then the impact of that decision? Were those contractors, did the banks or financial institutions just have no contractors, and did they just use their own permanent workforce instead, or what was happening at that time?
It's a bit of everything, really. Some people were offered permanent positions.
Okay.
At significantly less money than what they were earning as a contractor. So the Treasury would have ended up with less money.
Yeah.
Makes sense. If you're going from freelance to permy, Treasury ends up with less money. End of, period.
Yeah.
There's no way they end up with more money. The other way was they put them onto agency payroll, typically temps. You know, everyone knows what a temp is. So some of, you know, an overpriced temp might be a contractor on 400 a day. So they went onto agency payroll. And sometimes they just outsourced that work and they push it off to one of their other companies, other locations. You know, banks have locations all over the world. So
yeah,
we saw some banks pushing the work and just getting it done by their IT teams in New York, or sometimes they might outsource it to a consultancy that they used, you know, in India or Eastern Europe or something. Work was actually taken out of the UK, and jobs were lost in that respect.
That's a really good point, actually, because I remember doing some campaigning around this at the time in my previous role. And one of the things I was quite concerned about was the impact of that legislation coming in around the time of Brexit. Now, I don't really want to get into Brexit, but one of the political things around Brexit is the UK has to be attractive for business. We have to stay open for business. And actually, this piece of legislation has, in some situations, then had the reverse impact. I think that's what I'm saying. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, I'd entirely agree. This piece of legislation says we're closed for business because companies can no longer operate and hire, medium and large companies can no longer operate and hire freelance resource on a very quick, friction-free way and a risk-free way. And they end up with a risk on their balance sheet if they try to do it. So this is awful legislation in terms of attracting companies to the UK.
Yeah, Yeah, and the timing now, it's been sort of postponed to next year. That's going to be exactly the time of Brexit, which was one of the reasons why we the sector were campaigning around the Brexit thing, because those two significant changes coming in at once could be massive. But while you were just talking then, you've reminded me of an exception to the changes next year. So just very, very briefly, you mentioned small companies. What is that exception?
So, yeah, I mean, when they were proposing that this was coming in actually for 2019, it was delayed for 2019. And Philip Hammond, he said, we're going to delay it for a year, do more consultation, but there will be an exemption for small companies. So if you are a contractor and you're working for a small company, as defined by the Companies Act, then the original legislation applies and you assess yourself. Whereas if you are working for a medium or large company, then they do the assessment.
I can't remember the Companies Act definition, and I will put it in the show notes anyway.
There's three criteria, and as you say, you can put that up for people, but typically we will see most contractors working for medium or large companies. Yeah.
My understanding from it is it's based on their last published accounts, and so given the time frame that businesses publish their accounts anyway, you could have quite a lag time where a company might be medium or large, but actually you're working for them as if they're a small company. And it's all very confusing and complicated. And I think really my own personal view is, if you're listening to this and you're a contractor and you're wondering if it applies, just assume that you will be affected by these changes coming in next year if you work for a limited company, because I think very, very much most of the assignments and contracts out there will be. Okay. So are there any kind of top tips, just to conclude, you know, before we get into more detail, are there any sort of top tips for people to help them prepare? What can people do that are listening? Because I think a lot of this must feel a bit out of their control. So is there anything that people can do?
Yes, I think people should educate themselves. There's lots of misinformation in the market, and I think it's important that contractors understand what is the truth. There's lots that's been written about IR35 for the last 20 years. I'm going to now plug my book in a blatant manner. So I wrote a book in March called IR35 and Off Payroll Explained. It's about 300 pages. It's available on Amazon. It's £15. The first three chapters are available for free if you wish to download them in digital form from IR35 Shield website. So start with that. Educate yourself. Understand what the actual truth is, and so you're not misinformed, and then from there work out what your strategy is going to be going forward.
And I think that's so true, because I think some of the listeners will be quite new to this world, and probably may not have even heard of IR35 before listening today. It is a complicated thing, and we are going to record another episode, to kind of a more of an advanced episode, if you like, to talk about the detail of IR35 and you know what might indicate someone being inside IR35 or outside IR35. So we will be going into that in our next episode. There are lots of resources out there. From my perspective, I've known yourself, Dave, for probably about 6-7 years now. And so I can and do know that he knows his stuff. So, you know, it's a good recommendation to get the book. And I'm not on commission, I promise.
There's not enough money in it for there to be any commission.
Yeah, that's true, actually. The price is, not bad. You might want to look at that, actually.
Yeah, books don't make money. It is a complicated subject, but most of the complication for IR35 is around the phrase IR35 status, trying to understand whether you are inside IR35 or outside IR35. The rest of it is just admin and process. The complicated bit is working out what status you are. The rest of it's easy.
Brilliant. Well, we will be covering off some of that complicated stuff in our next episode. So thank you so much, Dave, for joining us today. It's been really, really interesting, and I'm sure our listeners will have got a lot out of it, and look forward to talking to you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to All About Self-Employment, hosted by Julia Kermode. For more information on today's discussion, please visit iwork.co.uk, where you can also join our growing community. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, then we would love you to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. We'll be back at the same time next week.